This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Ruhib coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are just going into the rain season. Starting this month, we are going to be starting to be receiving our rains. And most of the areas in the rural areas are impassable during the rain season. So we cannot go there and move any food to kind like save the lives, as it were. Anything beyond that period would mean that we would not be able to move the food and also be in a position to be reaching out to those needy communities.
There is Daniel Muchena, South Sudan Country Director for the humanitarian organization Plan International. He says time is running out for hundreds of thousands of people in dire need of food and supplies in South Sudan. Full details coming up.
Also, the Red Cross says the number of people in Kenya needing emergency food aid has doubled in the past 3 months to 3 million. And conflicts and protracted humanitarian crises are threatening food security in the Near East and North Africa.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the Red Cross says the number of people in Kenya needing emergency food aid has doubled in the past 3 months to 3 million, and it warns that the number could rise to 4 million in the coming weeks. AFP quotes Kenya Red Cross Secretary General Dr. Abbas Gulat as saying the situation is getting worse every day. He says that malnutrition rates among children are steadily climbing and that children are getting sick. More than 340,000 children under age 5 are listed as being acute malnourished. Gulat says the livelihoods of many families have been decimated after the loss of thousands of livestock in the ongoing drought. The drought has also triggered violent clashes between pastoralist communities, leaving at least 30 dead.
A humanitarian agency warns that hundreds of thousands of children in South Sudan are at risk of dying if they're not soon provided with food relief. Plan International says time is running out due to the impending onset of the rainy season. Daniel Muchena is the group's country director for South Sudan. He is calling on the government and rebels to allow humanitarian organizations access to the country's unity state, where access has been heavily restricted due to fighting and insecurity. Muchena spoke with me about his urgent call to allow for safe passage and access for humanitarian assistance to get to the most vulnerable people.
The reason why I'm saying that is we are just going into the rain season. Starting this month, we are going to be starting to be receiving our rains, and most of the areas in the rural areas are impassable during the rain season. So we cannot go there and move any food to kind like save the lives, as it were. Anything beyond that period would mean that we would not be able to move the food and also be in a position to be reaching out to those needy communities.
So what needs to be done so that you all can access the people? So
we are calling the government to facilitate access to the communities now so that the humanitarian organizations are able to reach to those people that are in a famine situation. What is happening now is that we cannot go to those areas because there's fighting that is taking place, and also even along the way, when people are driving to those areas, they are falling into some ambushes, like what happened over the weekend. Some six, eight workers were killed who were traveling from Juba to Pibo. So those are the kind of situations that we are calling upon the government to act upon.
Have you been able to gain access into Unity State?
Ourselves as Plan International, we have not managed to. Some organizations are doing some airdrops that are going in during the day and fly out. They cannot continue to be in the area because there is fighting going on. Though, of course, the government has assured international organizations to say they will facilitate that movement. But there is no free access as we can talk now. The people that received some aid, it was through some airdrops by WFP who went in just to do some airdrops and it reached out to a number of people. But as you know, there could be a lot of malnourished children that are in that area that require personalized attention, and that cannot happen now because of that insecurity.
What more does the international community need to do at this point?
I think the international community has to engage with both the government and the opposition that are fighting to really impress upon them to realize some kind of arrangement so that they can stop fighting and allow humanitarian access to reach out to the needy people. And also the other call for the international community is to be providing aid, because the aid is needed now. We need to release the funds and also the support to the communities, which is not really forthcoming now. Whatever we are getting are very limited resources that are not able to meet all the needs that are on the ground.
What will the months ahead be like if the food crisis continues as it is now?
If the situation goes unabated, it means we will see a situation where people get to the starving levels and even some lives will be lost. So we really require some support as a matter of urgency.
Daniel Muchena is Plan International's country director for South Sudan. He spoke with me from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
As the breakaway Republic of Somaliland grapples with a severe drought, medical workers are struggling to aid people left weakened by hunger. VOA's Abdulaziz Osman filed this report from a local hospital in Erigavo, the capital of Sanga region. Rob Rafael narrates his report.
This 70-year-old hospital is operating beyond full capacity to treat people affected by the drought. And it's the only hospital in Somaliland's Sanaag region. The drought has left tens of thousands of children acutely malnourished. In desperate need of treatment, they are checked as they lie on the beds in the stabilization center ward. The hospital's director says most of the admitted children come from rural areas.
The drought forced most pastoralists to move from one area into another. Some came to the cities, but most of the malnourished children admitted here are from the rural area.
Adiris Salah, a 14-month-old boy, weighed just over 6 kilograms when he was brought to the hospital from the Durar IDP camp. His mother, fighting back tears, says her son was suffering from severe diarrhea and malnutrition. His doctor said Salah is improving and now weighs 7.2 kilograms.
He was very weak when he was referred here. His weight and height were too low. We put him in the stabilization center as he was in the severely malnourished cafeteria. The initial phase, he couldn't take the feeding or the milk, so we inserted the NG tube to increase his feeding. Now, he still has the NG tube.
Medical officials say some families in the drought-stricken area cannot afford to bring their children to local medical centers, but doctors encourage parents to make the trip if they can.
In rural areas, sometimes families with malnourished children are not able to bring them to hospitals. So, for example, if a mother has 10 kids and 5 of them are malnourished, we beg her to bring the sick children to a hospital.
The United Nations has said more than 6 million people across Somalia and Somaliland are in need of help due to the extended drought, which shows no sign of ending. For Abdulaziz Osman, I'm Robert Rafael, VOA News.
Conflicts and protracted humanitarian crises are threatening food security in the Near East and North Africa. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says water scarcity and climate change are adding to the problem. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
A new report says wars and the widespread human tragedy they cause could reverse the gains made in the Naina region against hunger and poverty. Abdelsalam Ould Ahmed is FAO Assistant Director General and Regional Representative for the Near East and North Africa.
The food security situation has been deteriorating very, very rapidly over the last couple of years.
Speaking from Cairo, he says the region never used to be a hotspot when it came to food insecurity. But that's changed. Ahmed says the problem is growing at a faster pace than almost any other region.
The number of undernourished people have almost doubled since 1990, and the prevalence of undernourishment is now estimated to be around 9.5%.
9.5% represents about 30 million people. The FAO Assistant Director General says conditions are much worse in the Near East than in North Africa.
The situation in North Africa is better than the Near East. because obviously the crisis there is limited now to Libya, and Libya is a rich oil country, and we have not seen yet the huge impact on food security that we are witnessing in the Near East because of the Syria crisis, Iraq crisis, and because of the Yemen crisis and their impact to the surrounding countries. This is where today the highest number of food insecure in the region is located.
Ahmed says the effects of conflict are made worse by climate change and scarce water resources. Those resources are being strained by a rapidly growing population and huge demands by agriculture. 80% of available water goes to growing food and raising livestock.
What is the future holding for us? We can't obviously keep giving more water to agriculture.
The report recommends planting new varieties of crops that use less water and are salt tolerant. Other measures include converting from grain crops to fruits and vegetables and reducing food waste. 30% of the food produced in the region is lost somewhere along the supply chain, whether it be during harvesting, storage, transport, or consumer use.
If we were able simply to reduce that amount by 50%, it will already contribute to increasing significantly the food supply while indirectly saving water resources.
The FAO also urges countries in the Near East and North Africa to find ways to increase the supply of water and access to it. Options include treating wastewater, such as runoff from farms and urban areas, harvesting rainwater, and building desalinization projects. The FAO report says countries such as Algeria, Jordan, Mauritania, Morocco, Sudan, Syria, and Tunisia all highlight the threat of climate change to their water security. Ahmed says making the recommendations a reality will take political will and a lot of money. But he says there's a lot of support for them both inside and outside the region. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Seventeen past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The number of migrants who've crossed the Mediterranean to Europe so far this year has reached nearly 26,600, and nearly 650 have died trying to make the journey. The International Organization for Migration says about 22,000 of the migrants arrived in Italy. More than 3,600 landed in Greece and about 1,000 in Spain. In other migrant news, the European Commission says Hungary must guarantee its new migrant detention policy does not violate EU rules for those seeking asylum. Hungary is detaining migrants at its border, but the Commission says the government has agreed to work on legislation calling for migrants to be housed in camps while their asylum applications are considered. However, the UN Refugee Agency warns it's against the law to detain children. It says the proposed legislation would allow children over the age of 14 to be held in shipping containers at the border. Reuters reports Hungary has placed more than 300 shipping containers in two transit zones at its border with Serbia.
This week, government ministers and education-oriented NGOs gather in Argentina for the second international conference on safe schools. The meeting is sponsored by the international charity Education Above All and its program called Protecting Education in Security and Conflict. It seeks international support for the Safe Schools Declaration, which aims to protect schools from attack and conflict areas. So far, 60 states have signed the non-binding document. VOA's William Eagle spoke with an academic advisor to the charity, Malaika Malik, about the impact of attacks on children.
Attacks on education and military use of school impacts on hundreds of thousands of children. Just to give you a couple of examples from Africa, in the Central African Republic during late 2012, 2013, 100 schools were damaged, destroyed or looted, 24 used for military purposes, and a recent assessment in the country found that 30% of schools had been attacked. South Sudan, for example, 31% of schools have been attacked, and we know that there have been 273 separate cases of attacks around the country in the great Upper Nile region.
Tell us more about the Safe Schools Declaration. How many countries have signed so far, and what does it suggest that they do?
It's an intergovernmental political commitment which allows states to join up and commit to taking sensible actions, really common sense steps, to make it less likely that students, teachers, universities will be attacked. And the measures include providing assistance to victims of attack, promoting conflict-sensitive approach. Probably in Africa, the most important measure is a guideline to protect schools and universities from military use, because school buildings are a really valuable asset during a conflict, which are used by both the state and armed non-state actors. It's a very important way in which attacks to education can be prevented, and we can take sensible steps to make sure that children who are living during armed conflict and during insecurity can have access to education. Just to give you some figures, there's been fantastic momentum building up in time for Argentina, so that we now have France joined in February, Canada has joined, we're hoping there'll be other countries joining. We're in about 60 countries at the moment, and we're hoping that that'll increase up to 100 sometime soon. In terms of African countries, it's quite a good list, actually, not comprehensive, but Angola's a member, Chad, Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Niger. Nigeria is very significant because of attacks on education in Boko Haram, but also Somalia, South Sudan are also signatories. And so there is quite a good momentum, quite a good list of African countries who I think are members.
Is there any outreach to non-state actors in terms of having them interested or signing the Safe Schools Declaration?
There's an organization called Geneva Call, based in Geneva, that's done fantastic work in reaching out to armed non-state actors, including armed non-state actors in Africa and the sub-Saharan Africa. And they had a conference last year where half a day was devoted to working with armed non-state actors, informing them about the Safe Schools Declaration, but also informing them about the practical measures they can take to make sure that they don't recruit children under their control into armed groups, that they try and make sure that children are safely handed over to agencies such as UNICEF or Save the Children, and to make sure they respect children who are under their control as children, rather than trying to use them as an asset of war.
What do you hope to accomplish at the Safe Schools Conference in Argentina?
I think what would be fantastic to get from the conference is to carry on allowing states who have endorsed to come together and put international pressure on states that haven't yet endorsed. And I think it's a matter of great regret to me that my own country, the United Kingdom, hasn't signed up to the Safe Schools Declaration. I think the United States would be a fantastic leadership role if they were able to sign up to the Safe Schools Declaration as a sign of their global leadership in safeguarding education. I think there might be some potential within the European Union that if Germany could be persuaded to sign up, that would provide fantastic leadership in Europe towards strengthening global governance to safeguard education during war and conflict.
That was Malaya Malik, an advisor to the international charity Education Above All. She spoke with reporter William Eagle.
Until recently, many scientists believed that the use of tools is what set human beings apart from other primates. But many of those other primates are now able to use simple tools. So anthropologists and others working in Africa now say it may actually be complex communication, including language, that distinguishes humans from other primates. An expedition to the shores of Lake Turkana, co-sponsored by the National Museum of Kenya, may help settle the question. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with George Washington University anthropologist David Braun, one of the project's lead researchers.
We're going to be spending some time this summer on the eastern shores of Lake Turkana, looking at sediments that are between 4 and 2 million years old. And we're trying to identify places where some of the earliest evidence of tool use amongst human ancestors have been found. And we're very lucky that we have sediments of that age over a very large area, hundreds of kilometers.
Now, I understand that things have changed in terms of your understanding of those eras in the last 3, 4, 5 years, you said.
Yes. For a very long time, there was the assumption that one of the features that distinguishes humans from almost all other animals was the use of tools. But we now know that tool use goes back way deep in the human ancestry, and that many different primates use tools. So we're spending this summer not only looking for other evidence of that tool use, but also trying to understand what type of environments these early humans were living in when they were making and using these earliest stone tools.
What kind of tools are they, and why was that useful for them?
They use a lot of breaking tools to make sharp edges, but they also use a lot of tools for pounding, and this could have been either for cracking nuts as a possibility. That's certainly what chimpanzees use tools for. And after a certain point, tools that we see at 3.3 million years ago, they actually are hitting one rock against another, and it creates a sharp edge. And that sharp edge, we know they were using those to actually cut presumably pieces of meat or other resources from large mammal carcasses. And in Ethiopia, there is evidence of cut marks from butchery practices on large bones from large mammals.
In a way, watching, observing somebody making a tool could happen very, very early, because maybe someone didn't say, well, you have to chip it there or don't hit it too hard. You just watch the other animal or the other sort of proto-hominid do what they do, and then you do it yourself. And that's how the transmission occurred. So it could be much more ancient even than primates are.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the things that was remarkable about some of the earliest stone tools that we had found was that we saw that they would select certain rocks to make into stone artifacts. And it was somewhat incredible to think that these really early humans somehow had an understanding of the sort of mechanical properties of these stones. But when we then looked at chimpanzees, we realized that all it took was emulation of behaviors between individuals that are good at tool use and those that are learning. And chimpanzees will eventually only use certain rock types and create a pattern very similar to what we see in the archaeological record. And that would suggest that, well, you don't need the human types of communication capabilities to create that particular feature of the archaeological record.
Are you saying that the search for these tools and their relative occurrence in different layers of sediment is really a project about language and how cultural transmission occurs?
It's not necessarily language, because making a link between language and tools is very difficult, but it is a search for the very detailed foundations of what is it that makes us unique. And when did humans cross a threshold whereby the transmission of information between two individuals goes from sort of rudimentary enhancement of behaviors to the full-blown communication that we see between modern humans?
And Africa is really sort of the ground zero for a lot of this knowledge, isn't it?
Absolutely. The sediments that we find these artifacts in and the associated materials that allow us to provide an age for them, from South Africa up the Rift Valley up into Ethiopia, sites all along there are really the only place that you can look for this information.
That was anthropology professor David Braun of George Washington University. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
And stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Linor Moudou, host of Health Chat. Join us this Tuesday as we take a look at tuberculosis, featuring the movie The Lucky Specials, with my guests, South Africa celebrity Oros Mampofu and lead actor of the movie The Lucky Specials, along with other guests. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-691-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.